Good morning. I'd like to welcome you this morning to the live stream of Grace Life Bible Church, our adult Sunday school class. For the past number of years, we've been meeting at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning to study issues related to the inspiration, preservation, transmission, and translation of the Word of God. And this morning is going to be a little bit different. I'm already seeing a question from Blake and Amy here. The question is, what happened to the beard? Well, the reality of that question, Blake, since you're dying to know, is that I stalled out this week as far as the weight loss goes. And so being true to my word, we have gotten rid of it. And whether or not it's coming back is kind of up in the air. Becky doesn't particularly like the beard. And, you know, so I am about trying to maintain domestic tranquility, if you will. So we'll see if the beard comes back or not. I'm sort of, you know, 50-50 on that. The goal to lose weight, though, has not gone away. But staying true to my word, I had hit a bit of a snag this past week and did not lose the required amount to keep the beard. So that's where the beard is, or lack thereof, I should say. So this morning what I want to do is I want to have a little bit of a Q&A. I have a topic or a presentation that I've planned to do, and then hopefully as I share some of that information with you, then some questions will come up and you can ask the questions here. So on my laptop in front of me here, I have open the YouTube feed. I have everything muted and stuff, but if questions come up in the chat, I'll be able to address those questions, answer those questions. So if you want to ask a question, and again, I want you to try to keep a question to the subject matter that we've been studying in this hour, which is the biblical text, its inspiration, preservation, transmission, translation, etc., the stuff that we've been covering in this hour. So if you have a question that you want to ask, put it there in the live chat as we get started here. And if there are no questions, then we'll just call it a day. I'm going to have to call it a day at 10 o'clock anyway so that I can end this stream, get everything reset here on my streaming equipment so that we can go live for our main service at 10:30. So the first thing I want to kind of talk about is last Sunday in Lesson 117, we talked about the Coverdale Bible and how the Coverdale Bible set trends as far as what was included within the Bible, as far as the ancillary or front material, the back material. We talked about the layout and the setting up and the editing of it as far as doctrine and formatting goes, particularly with the Apocrypha. And I want to show you a couple things here this morning along those lines so that you can kind of see what happened with the printing of the English Bible. And I don't know how many of you actually own a 1611 King James Bible, not an original, obviously, which would be worth, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, but a reprint. You can buy a reprint from Thomas Nelson and other places. They'll reprint that. There's also websites online that will allow you to be able to access the pages of a 1611. And I thought I had that site bookmarked, but apparently the King James Bible. If you go to the website, the King James Bible Online, thekingjamesbibleonline.org, you can access the entire 1611 King James Version right there. You can download PDFs of every page, pictures. You can access the text both in its the original spellings of 1611 as well as the more updated spellings of the 1769 edition. So on the matter of Bibles being printed, etc., I have a Bible here. This is an American printing. This is nearly 200 years old. This is published. This was published by in Luxembourg, Massachusetts. And the publication date on this is 1829. So this is an 1829 American printing of the King James Bible. And there are, it says right in here that there's an alphabetical table and plates. And if you just start looking at this, so if you look at it, there's a preface to the reader included here. And then you have some, you know, pretty standard front material, including a title or a table of contents page right here that's got the table of contents, and then it gets right into the text of the book of Genesis. Now, this one also does have the Apocrypha in it, and I'm going to find that for you, but it is also, like we saw last Sunday with the Coverdale Bible, it's located between the Testaments. So again, this is an American printing here from 1829, and this is nearly 200 years old, but it does have the Apocrypha in it, according to the, so here's the end of the Old Testament, right there. And then on the next page, you've got, actually, this is interesting now, I'll have to show you this. On the next page, you've got the family records page. So this particular Bible, published in 1829, the first entry in here is a marriage from 1837. And then it goes through, and there's entries in here and dating all the way back to 1837. And then, interestingly enough, this particular Bible goes to straight to the New Testament. Now, the reason I said that about the Apocrypha is because if you go back to the first page, actually, this is interesting too, just real quick. This right here, this says dated April the 1st, 1831. So this Bible was originally a gift to the original owner, the property of William Musselman, Bout Romulus, April 1st, 1831 is the date on here. But anyway, back to the Apocrypha. If you look at this table of contents page, it actually lists the books called Apocrypha here, right there. I'm sorry, nope, right here, between the Testaments. But then if you actually go and look at it, it's not there. So it's probably because I'm a dork and a nerd, but I'm fascinated by looking at old Bibles. This is, an American printing from 1829, so this one is nearly 200 years old. Now, I have another one here. This Bible that I'm about to show you, this was the property of, this is the family Bible of the Blaine family. Becky's grandmother, Joan Blaine, gave this to me a number of years ago, and this was the family Bible, okay? Massive family Bible. Here's the front of it. This is a hard, almost like a wood cover on this thing, the Holy Bible, and this is the size of this family Bible here, okay? So I want to show you, I want to give you kind of a visual understanding of what happened with American Bible printing once the text started to be printed in the United States. So if I open this Bible up, I have this page bookmarked. I'll try to show you this here. I have this page bookmarked, and if I hold this up to the camera, you can see that on this page here is where you first start to see the text of the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, okay? That means that all this front material, all of this, over nearly 400 or 500 pages, all of this is ancillary additional material. In other words, it's stuff that was added by the publisher that is not the biblical text. Okay, so this particular family Bible, it's got all kinds of stuff in it. Maps, books of the Bible, drawings of biblical scenes. It's got the coins mentioned in the Bible. It's got all sorts of stuff. And let me just give you a little bit of a flavor of what I'm talking about here. So here's drawings here of biblical scenery. So you can see what happened here to the two Bibles as American publishers started printing them. Now, this particular Bible, this one is from 1877. So this is still, and this is called the Latest Illustrated Reference Family Bible. And this thing is copyrighted, this particular edition. It's complete with a Cruden's Concordance, a comprehensive Bible dictionary. It has a concise history of all religious denominations. and this thing was published in 1877. So you can see that, you know, so this is a family Bible from 1877, and here's my Scofield Reference Bible. I mean, you look at the comparison here, you can almost fit two Scofield Reference Bibles in there with how big this particular Bible is. So my point is that the Bible, even the King James text, even those who were printing the King James text, over time just added more and more and more ancillary and additional information to it to, you know, to try to sell Bibles, really is what they're doing. And so, you know, if you had this family Bible here, and this is the only Bible you had, you'd have the King James text, but you'd have all sorts of other things, including a concordance, maps, charts, you know, far more extensive even than what you would get in a modern study Bible today. So it's interesting just to look at the history of printed Bibles. Okay, now I've got a question here. It says, do you know if I can get it on Blue Letter Bible? So, Blake, I'm not sure if you're referring to... I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. This Family Illustrated Bible is not available on Blue Letter Bible. Neither is the Edmund Cushing edition from 1829. None of those are available there on Blue Letter Bible. Blue Letter Bible is pretty much just the base text of a 1769 King James Bible, and then obviously there are other ones. Oh, the 1611. You cannot get the 1611, to my knowledge, on Blue Letter Bible. I'm going to copy the link here of where you can get this online King James Bible. I'm pasting a link right now into the live stream for where you could access the King James Bible in its 1611 format online for free, and you can look at all of the pictures and so forth there. So that's pretty much what I was going to show you. If there's no other questions, I'm hoping there will be some questions. If there's no other questions, then you know, we can sign off. I do have other historical Bibles. I've shown some of these in church. You can get reprints of a lot of these. So this is a 1537 Matthews Bible. Now this is the next one we're going to be talking about here. You can buy this in the store where they've done a photostatic reprint of a 1537 Matthews Bible. So that's what one looked like if you actually had one. Okay. I also have I've shown folks before. I have a 1526 Tyndale New Testament over there, but then I also have a 1560 Geneva Bible. 1560 Geneva Bible. These are published by Hendrickson, and they're photostatic reprints of a 1560 Geneva Bible. So you can see that this got footnotes and so forth, right? So you can really study and have a lot of good access to this information just by what's available. And then I have a 1599 Geneva Bible. The 1599 Geneva Bible, this is also known as the Pilgrim Edition, because this is the one that the Pilgrims brought with them on the Mayflower, was a 1599 Geneva Edition. So there's also some evidence to suggest that there was also a 1611 King James Bible also on the Mayflower. But you've got a lot of stuff here as far as historical data. If you want to look at what was going on with these Bibles, they're certainly available to you. The other thing I'd say is, and I'm not going to be able to show you this with my current setup, but you can access, maybe I can if you bear with me for a second, you can access a ton of this material online if you're searching for the right PDFs. You know, one of the things that folks will ask me from time to time is, how do you find this stuff? How do you find these resources? How do you locate them? How do you access them? And really, it's in large part a matter of knowing. Obviously, you got to know where to look, but a lot of it's available on the internet. So I'm gonna use my tablet here, and I'm going to open something up to show you what I'm talking about. So last Sunday when we were doing lesson 117, and I was showing you those images there of a Coverdale's Bible in the notes, I want to show you, I actually have right here, this is a photostatic reprint. This is a PDF of a 1535 Coverdale Bible in PDF format that I pulled off the internet. So almost all of this material that I'm showing you here is pretty much available online for free if you know where to look. You need to be searching things like archive.org. You need to be searching things like Google Books. Anything that is generally over 100 years old or anything that has fallen out of current copyright, you can generally access for free. In Google Books, so let me just kind of show you how you can do this. Again, just bear with me here for a moment. I'm just going to go to Google. So hopefully you can see that. I've just got a Google tab open here, and I'm going to type in 1535 Coverdale Bible. Okay. 1535 Coverdale Bible. I just did a search, right? So I get one for Wikipedia. I get one for all sorts of different places, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to refine that search. I didn't find what I want. I'm going to say PDF. So I'm looking for a 1535 Coverdale Bible in PDF. Okay. And I see an entry here. It says archive. Hopefully you can see that. There's an entry there that says archive.org. Okay. So I'm going to click archive.org. And when I click archive.org, it opens up the Internet Archive, and there is, for free, the 1535 Coverdale Bible. All right? And then if you scroll down on this screen, you have, right on this side, on this side over here where I'm pointing to, you have download options. So you can download this in different formats straight to your computer, and save the file and capture this and have this information literally forever, okay? So, you know, I recommend that folks take advantage of these things. Obviously there's a lot of evil things on the internet, right? A lot of bad things, a lot of things that, you know, are not edifying and so forth, but the amount of information that's available for you to study and research and learn from on the internet is just absolutely astounding if you know where you're going and what you're doing. So all of those editions of the Coverdale Bible that I've shown in the last 4 weeks, the Diglot Latin versions, all of that stuff that I've shown is available online on the internet for people to. So here I will show you this. Here's the, if I can get it open here. Here's the 1538, 1537, 1538 Diglot version. Okay, this is the version of Coverdale where he's got parallel columns with the Latin Vulgate. So you can see all of this stuff, and it's absolutely fascinating. Let me just show you a page from that so that you can see what I'm talking about. It's important for people to realize that anyone who knows how to work the internet can access this stuff and use this stuff to study from. So I don't know why this isn't getting any bigger, but you can see that page there. In one column is Latin, and then the other column is English. And that is the book of Matthew. That's the book of Genesis there, okay, the first book of the Bible. So it's really quite amazing and quite astounding what you can do if you know where to look and be able to access all this information and material, okay? So I got a question here. What is your process to determine what information you are looking up on a subject is accurate and true, even from credible and educated people? It's a great question, okay? So, Blake, I appreciate that question, especially since you're keeping this thing going here a little bit. So the question again is, what is your process to determine what information you are looking up on a subject is accurate and true, even from credible and educated people? So the biggest thing that you need to do when you are doing any sort of research is you need to check the footnotes. And you need to footnote mine. What I call it footnote mining, right? So here's a copy of my book, The King James Bible in America, right? Now, some of you might not be finding this too interesting or whatever, but for those of you that are still with me, hopefully you'll find this interesting. So I've got footnotes in this book at the bottom of the page, right? Any book I read, I pay attention to the footnotes. I pay attention to what sources are being used by a particular author to make the points that they're trying to make. And then I go and I find those sources, and I look at those citations, and I look at those pages, and I read, are they accurately representing it? Is there, when I find the source they used, can I go back even further? And then I try to find, always I try to find the oldest and, if I can, the primary source. The main source that is being used to make a given point, and I read it myself. So I'm in the middle of this right now with some stuff about the American Revolution, and I mentioned this in one of my Wednesday night Bible studies, my most recent one from 2 weeks ago now, on the issue of the American Revolution. So what I'm in the process of doing is trying to study what were pastors at the time of the American Revolution. What were they thinking? What were they studying? What were they preaching? Okay? So instead of just going to a book that's written by a guy who's going to tell me through his filter or through his perspective or through his lens what he thinks about something, what you want to do is you want to go to the primary sources, okay? The primary sources would be the actual text of the sermons that were delivered by these preachers themselves. And so you can find these things reprinted in compendiums and so on and so forth of information. So this particular one that I'm studying right here, I've got it marked, so I'll just hold it up here for you to look at. Is it says, this one is called On Civil Liberty and Passive Disobedience, and this is preached by a guy named Jonathan Boucher in 1775, okay? So I found this, and then there's a statement here. So I'm kind of just, this is a sort of a research process question, I guess, that Blake's asked. And in this primary source, they had the sermon that I was looking for, but then there was a note that says, it says this about this particular sermon. Boucher was an Episcopal minister and tutor to others, among others, the stepson of George Washington, a loyalist or Tory. He believed the colonists had no right to rebel against the acts of Parliament. Boucher preached non-resistance in an increasingly hostile audience in 1775. When fearing for his life, he returned to England. In 1797, he published 13 of his sermons against the colonial resistance under the title A View of the Causes and Consequences of the American Revolution, right? So I know from another book that this sermon exists by this Boucher guy on civil liberty, passive disobedience, and non-resistance, right? So what I'm then looking for is, well, where can I find the text of that sermon completely naked without any comment? Without any commentary, without any filter or anything like that, right? So I find this book, The American Republic, the primary sources, and I have the document. Then I source this entry at the top of the page that explains to me about the document, and I find out that this sermon is part of a compendium of 13 sermons that this guy preached called A View of the Causes and Consequences of the American Revolution. So then I go to Amazon and I say, can I find that book? Can I find A View on the Causes and Consequences of the American Revolution from 1779? And lo and behold, there it is. all 13 sermons in nearly 600 pages of edification, if you want to read all of it, right? So to answer the question, you have to be willing to trace everything back. If I'm going to determine the reliability, it's not simply a matter of, you know, do I think this guy's telling the truth or not? It's fact checking and sourcing and doing a lot of the work yourself. Is kind of what I'm getting at there with that question, Blake. So I don't know if I'm helping you or if I'm just saying, boy, you're just making things a lot more difficult. But this book here, A View on the Consequences of the Causes and Consequences of the American Revolution, guess where you can find that book for free? You can find that book for free if you search it in so I'm going to go back to Google. So here's my Google screen. I'm going to search for A View of the Causes and Consequences. So give me just a moment to type this in, and I'll show you what I come up with just by doing a little bit of research here. So A View of the Causes and Consequences, and it's already showing it. A View of the Causes and Consequences of the American Revolution. And then I see here it says Google Books. So I'm going to click that one. I'm going to click the one for Google Books. So it's going to load it. I'm going to click that, and it's going to take me to the book. And then in this upper, it would be your upper right-hand corner, there's this little gear button. I'm going to push that little gear button, and lo and behold, one of my options is download PDF. So this entire book that I paid $16.99 for on the causes and consequences of the American Revolution is available right there for free as a PDF, which I have also downloaded, by the way. So you really have to be willing to check this stuff, okay? Let me see here. Another question, it says, so Blake, if I didn't answer your question, just notify me there. Oh, sweet. Thank you. Okay, cool. Peter Positive asked a question. Thank you. Is the Didache used by most modern church theology foundations? I'm new to rightly dividing. Thank God, Peter. So, Peter, I would need to know, I think, a little bit more information about what you mean by the Didache. I think I know what you mean, but before I would even attempt an answer, not that I know if I can even answer that question off the top of my head. It kind of depends on what you mean. I might be able to, I may not. I just need some more information. So, you know, I'm good with this. I've been thinking for a long time that I needed to do something, and I probably should do something obviously more organized than what this is, but really a maybe some process videos that walk people through a process of how to do some of this stuff. And, you know, not everybody needs to know how to do this. Not everyone is interested in doing this. But for those of you that are, and this is some of the process that I use to be able to produce these lessons. So it's not just reading something and believing it. I've got a whole shelf of books over here written by pro King James authors that I used to just take their word for it until I realized that I couldn't do that because they were saying things that when I actually checked the facts on what they were saying, it didn't check out. It wasn't true. And so I realized that you have to sometimes go a little bit further, okay? So the Peter Positive says it does not mention Paul, only 12 disciples teaching. So is the Didache used by modern church theology foundations? You know, I don't know, Peter, ultimately the answer to that. Most modern church theologies or denominational theologies are going to be just about teaching the doctrinal statement of the denomination, or the Reformed confessions or something like that. So I don't ultimately know the total answer to that question. I apologize for not being able to answer it off the top of my head. But my sense is that most modern church theology foundations are in large measure derived from the doctrinal statements or the confessional creedal statements of a particular Protestant denomination. Now, at some point, they might have looked at things like the Didache or the teaching of the 12 or something like that, but most people in most modern 21st century American evangelicals probably have no idea what the Didache even is. I've heard of it. I might have done a lesson on it in the Grace History Project. I'd have to go back and check on that. So I don't know if I'm answering that question any better. So we're at about 9:30. I've got 13 people with me. Hopefully you're not bored to death. Hopefully you're getting something out of this. I'll leave this open for another couple minutes. If you want to ask any other questions, if not, then we can just move on. Blake, I do appreciate the question there about how do you judge things, the accuracy of things, and so forth. For me, it's, does it check out upon further scrutiny? Is the source being quoted correctly? Does it, if there's a quotation, is there stuff left out of it? Is it being manufactured to read a certain way, like I've demonstrated multiple times with different things by Gail Ripplinger and so forth? There's no questions. Any other questions or anything you want to ask related to the text, inspiration, preservation, or translation? Peter Positive says that brilliant help. Frank, what is your view of Webster's, I think it's, you mean translation. So, what Frank is after there is, many people don't know this, the many King James advocates, they will use, they will use, promote, and tout Webster's American Dictionary of the English Language from 1828. And this is my hard copy. This is my hard copy of Webster's Dictionary from 1828. They'll tout this dictionary, and rightfully so, as being an important dictionary to use for the definition of biblical words, because Webster will use the dictionary, use the Bible in defining words in his dictionary. Fewer people are aware of the fact that Webster also did a translation, his own translation of the Bible. And I have looked at that, Frank, a little bit. Now, I've not studied that yet as extensively as I would want to, or maybe one day desire to do. And my opinion about it was honestly a little bit of a mixed bag. I am not a King James advocate who is a big stickler on the spelling of words, like thoroughly or throughly, for example, something like that, okay? So one of the things that Webster did in his Bible is he just updated the spelling and orthography of a lot of different English words. A lot of the changes that you'll find in a Webster Bible compared to a King James Bible, a lot of them are just that type of thing. The updating on the spelling of words, that kind of thing. I did encounter, and if you're going to ask me to give you the exact passages, I can't do it right now off the top of my head from memory, but I'll say this. There were some of the changes that Webster made that I observed I was uncomfortable with, because I felt like they were substantive changes. I felt like they were not just different ways of saying the same thing. I felt like some of his changes were creating, a substantive difference in meaning between the way he said it in his Bible and the way that the King James Bible said it. Now, let me look here on the internet, and I will share a source in the comments for you, Frank, where you can check this out for yourself, okay? So what you're going to want to do is, let me just make sure that Webster is here. Yes, Webster is here. Let me just click this. So I'm going to share with you a website. It's called BibleStudy.info. BibleStudy.info. I'll share this in the comments. And what you can do with this website is you can enter the reference, any biblical reference you want, okay? And then you can change and look it up in literally almost 100 different translations in other languages and all sorts of places, okay? So this is another resource that I've used quite extensively in this class. So I'm pasting this right now in here. It's called BibleStudy.info, and you can look at the Webster Bible and you can compare it yourself. So my answer on that is I don't know enough about it. I haven't studied it enough to make any kind of a comprehensive statement about it. I have looked at it some, and I found it to be a mixed bag. A lot of it is just the updating of spelling to American orthography. You know, that's a point I think I need to mention about this dictionary. This is an American dictionary of the English language. This dictionary is describing the meaning of English words in America, not in Britain. So this is recording how the words are used in America, how they're spelled in America, not necessarily how they're spelled in Britain. So you have to keep that in mind when you're reading a dictionary like this, because it's recording how the language is being spelled and working and being defined and how words are used in America, not necessarily in Britain, right? And we know that the King James Bible was translated in Britain, and so even to this day, you know, the British and Americans, we don't always spell words the same. So I think that the Webster's Bible is a bit of a mixed bag, and you're going to want to evaluate each reading on an individual basis. And I do think some of the changes that Webster made are substantive, meaning in my mind they would create a problem, and I would not be okay with some of the substantive, well, any change that he makes that's substantive, I would not be okay with. A change that's just a different way of saying the same thing, or the updating of the spelling of a word, I don't think that's in the same category as a substantive difference in meaning, okay? Another question here, again from Peter Positive. How would you answer a master's degree theologian who insists that I need to study Wayne Grudem's systematic theology to get my theology correct? I would ask that person to show you what verse in the Bible tells you to do that. That's what I would say. Maybe that's a little bit sarcastic, but honestly, that's what I would say is, yeah, well, that's great, but what verse in the Bible tells me to read, Wayne Grudem's systematic theology? Blake says, agree, 1828 Webster's Dictionary is a very good help, and there's a free app on the phone. So there is a free app. There's also free websites for that. I'll share a link to that. So I'll share a link also here in these live stream comments to Webster's 1828 Dictionary. If you are an internet user, you can use this link here. So there's that link. Question from Frank. What British dictionary would you recommend? So this is the American dictionary. So this is Webster. So again, I'm sorry I keep getting up, but you know, I'm just grabbing stuff to show here. These two bad boys here are the Webster, are the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, this is the compact edition of the Oxford English Dictionary. My father actually rescued these from, he garbage picked these. He rescued these from oblivion from somebody's trash back in the 1980s, right? So there's two massive volumes here, and if you open it up, here's what it looks like. It is so small that you need a magnifying glass to read this, okay? The Oxford English Dictionary, Frank, is by far the most thorough, the most complete, the most comprehensive treatment of the English language in a dictionary form. Now, you can buy a yearly subscription to the Oxford English Dictionary online. So if you wanted to buy your own copy, I would recommend a couple things. I would check Amazon for the, this one is the compact edition, and it should be in two volumes, okay? It should be an A through O and then P through Z, and then you'd have to get a magnifying glass to read it. That's one option. A third option would be, they used to put out a CD-ROM. I don't know if they still do that. I don't think they do, but you might find an old CD-ROM laying around on, you know, eBay or Amazon or something like that that you could use. The best thing that you can do, honestly, is to go to the Oxford English Dictionary website. And at the Oxford English Dictionary website, you can search it electronically, and you don't have to have all these books and magnifying glasses and, you know, all this sort of stuff to read it. I would also check, if you're interested in that, Frank, I would also go to your local public library and ask if your local public library has an online subscription to the Oxford English Dictionary. Many local public libraries will allow you or grant you access to the Oxford English Dictionary online through your library card. So I would definitely ask about that. And that's obviously the cheapest, because it would be absolutely free for you to do that. Definitely, if you're a Bible student, if you're a student of language, if you want to be able to look up and know every, you know, and know tons of information about the history and etymology of a word, you cannot do without the Oxford English Dictionary. But it's, again, it's more of a, it's a exhaustive British dictionary. It's not necessarily like the American dictionary. And a lot of people, especially King James advocates, they don't realize that what Webster's doing is he's telling you the meaning, usage, and spelling of word, English words in America, not necessarily in Britain. Okay? So, yeah, these are good questions. Hopefully this has been helpful. We've got a few minutes left. Is there any other topic or question related to any of this, or process question that somebody wants to ask? Blake says, quick note, they made a movie about the Oxford Dictionary, too, called The Professor and the Madman, inspired by the true events. Yes, Blake has told me about this movie. I have not had the opportunity to watch it yet, but it is definitely on my list. Sounds like an interesting movie, going through the process of how that was done. And by the way, you can find all old Bible. You can find a ton of old Bible printings in America. When I did the King James Bible in America, and in the back, you've got all these different editions and how they handled the different words and stuff. All these different editions, all this material was located via just research for free on the internet. It's all there. It's all available. You just have to know how to find it and where to use it. How to use it. I would like a feedback in the comment for those of 15 or 16 of you that are watching, just for my own personal sort of evaluation, would there be any benefit? Do you folks feel that there would be any benefit to me doing some sort of more structured lessons, walking through sort of the process of doing this type of research in a more sort of structured way? Right now I'm just sort of talking off the cuff, and I'm just grabbing stuff here and there and showing things and trying to interact with the audience in live time. Would there be any benefit to doing a more structured presentation, showing you, maybe even taking some examples of, you know, reading something and then how to backtrack that back to figure out with, you know, whether or not it's, you know, accurate? Unfortunately, a lot of people in our day, even believers in our day, will say that they've done their research and all they've done is watched a YouTube video. That's unfortunate, especially with all of the real you know, all of the real unfiltered data that's available through the internet, like I just showed you. It's really a fascinating thing, and there's really a lot of material out there. So Frank's saying, yes, I would find that helpful in doing research. Okay, I'm not making any promises, Frank, about when I might be prepared to actually teach that lesson, but it is something, like I said a moment ago, that I've had in my mind. You know, maybe I should do this. I don't know if there's any interest in that. So maybe there would be some, and I could think about how I could structure a lesson like that. So I appreciate that feedback. Anyone else with a question or a comment? We've got about 15 minutes before I need to end this and move on to something else. Peter Positive, yes, please. Thank you for your willingness. Be interesting to participate. Okay, so again, Peter, I appreciate that feedback. On that point, Blake and Amy say being a brand in our study as well. Yeah, I mean, when Paul says that, when he talks about being a brand and searching the scriptures, obviously he's referring to the Bible, but my personal opinion on that is that we need to be making sure that, you know, pretty much within the realm of possibility, we need to be making sure that the things that we're saying are accurate, especially when we're talking about the Bible. So the verse there is Acts 17, verse 11, where we read, "These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they searched the word with all readiness of mind, that they received the word with all readiness of mind, and searched the scriptures daily whether those things were so." I think, obviously, that verse is talking about your Bible study. It's talking about your reading of the Bible and searching things out and making sure they're so. But I think there's a Berean principle there that applies to basically anything that you would, in any sort of, you know, spiritual, intellectual investigation that you might ever enter into, that we need to make sure that what we're saying is accurate and factual and not, you know, based upon, you know, misinformation or only certain parts of information. And no human is infallible. No human is going to get everything right all the time. Even with the best research, et cetera, mistakes are going to be made and so forth. But the point is to try to limit that to the extent that you can. And that's the other thing I'll say here, you know, as we work our way to the closing is, If you're going to disagree, so if I've done research and I write this book, The King James Bible in America, okay? So if you read this book and you don't agree with it, let's say you read this book and you don't agree with it. So in the realm of the mind, in the realm of how arguments and ideas work, you can't just say, well, I don't agree with that book. I mean, you can say that. But if you're not going to agree with it, you would have to demonstrate what is wrong with it, why it's not correct, and then replace it with a positive argument of your own. And this is a thing that I just see too often going on right now with believers, is that folks are just like, well, that's not right, because almost like an argument from authority or an appeal to authority, because I say it's not, or Pastor so-and-so says it's not, or, you know, Wayne Gruden says so, or whoever it is, right? But then if I'm going to disagree with a position, I need to be able to, number one, identify what I think's wrong with it, and then number two, replace it with with my own positive argument for why I think my view is correct, right? So in philosophy, this is what we would call positive and negative arguments. Negative arguments are reasons why somebody's wrong. Positive arguments are you or I or somebody building a positive case for why their view is right. It is always, 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 always easier to say, well, I think Joe Schmo is wrong because of A, B, and C, than it is to say, well, I think Joe Schmo is wrong because of X, Y, and Z, and then here's what I think is the correct positive case, right? I think this is true in Bible study. I think this is true in historical study. I think this is true in every sort of, you know, endeavor or field of study, that you have to you have to do the due diligence. You have to do the job necessary. And if I'm going to disagree, if you're going to disagree with me, or I'm going to disagree with somebody else, it's not enough for me to just say, well, I don't agree with them. I have to be able to say why I don't agree with them, and then say, here's what I think the true alternative would be. And too many times, that's just not happening in the discourse and the conversations and the discussions that I engage in. It's easy to say, I think you're wrong, but it's much more difficult to say, here's why you're wrong, and here's what I think the correct view is. Peter asks, why do so many church organizations not pick up on Paul's secret mystery revelation recorded by Paul in his writings, as revealed by the resurrected Jesus more than 5 years after Pentecost? Two things: tradition and a failure to rightly divide the word of truth. Church tradition, the denominational tradition of a given church, doesn't recognize Pauline authority, doesn't recognize Paul's unique apostleship, doesn't recognize the mystery revealed to the Apostle Paul. And the other thing I'd say about that, Peter, is that the adversary does not want people to know about that. He does not want people to understand the wisdom of God in a mystery. Paul addresses that in Ephesians chapter 3. In Ephesians chapter 3, just bear with me for a second, we read this. Ephesians chapter 3, Paul says, unto me who am less than the least of all saints, this is chapter 3, verse 8, unto me who am less than the least of all saints is this grace given, that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the world hath been hid in God, who created all things by Jesus Christ, to the intent that now, unto the principalities and powers in heavenly places, might be known by the church the manifold wisdom of God. The mystery puts Satan and his cohorts to open shame for demonstrating and manifesting that they didn't know this information. The contest between God and Satan in your Bible has never been about power. It's never been about strength. It's never been about who had more power or anything like that. It's always been about wisdom. It's always been about who was the wise one and who better knew how to run the show, so to speak, right? And so God, in his wisdom, devises a plan to take the wise in their own craftiness by simply keeping a mystery about what he was going to do and what he was going to accomplish through the cross, through the formation of the church, the body of Christ, a topic that I'm going to be talking about shortly here at about around 10:30 when we get to our main Sunday morning message out of the book of Colossians. So as a result of that, the adversary doesn't want people to know about the revelation of the mystery. He doesn't want them to know about the church, the body of Christ. He's perfectly content for people to be scriptural, but not dispensational, to use the Bible, to profess the Bible, to claim the Bible, to use the Bible, but to use it inaccurately, to mishandle it, to not rightly divide it, to misapply it, and to think that they're a spiritual Israel or a group that they're not. And so the adversary is perfectly content to let people function in that confusion, in that lack of wisdom. So that's kind of the way I guess I would answer your question off the top of my head. So anyway, I appreciate you guys being here for this Q&A. My plan, I have a pretty busy week in front of me this week again. Those of you that are part of the assembly, you know that Fred Curtis died. I'm going to have to be a part of that funeral and other things. I don't know how much time I'm going to have to prepare a lesson the way that I normally would. So we might be doing something similar to this for next Sunday. So think about that and put your put some questions down that you might want to ask next Sunday morning at 9 if we do it in this format again. Peter Positive says there's a full-day Zoom conference in Seattle on the Manifest Wisdom of God, May 30th. I will try to share the details. And Blake says, thank you, Pastor Brian. This was beneficial. So I appreciate that, Blake. I appreciate the 15 or 16 of you that have been with me through this. I hope that this was something that you'll get something out of and that can at least be out there for a resource for some things. I'll give some thought to trying to put together something a little bit more structured and comprehensive on how to conduct and how to do some of this research with the tools and so on. And thanks for watching. I'm going to sign off right now. I'm going to end this stream, and we'll be back on here at 10:30 with our main message. So thanks for tuning in. I apologize it wasn't the normal lesson, but hopefully you were able to get something out of it anyway. Thanks.